Welcome back to the second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
If you just joined us, I'd like to let you know this is a two-hour show in which we balance the intellectual with the creative and where we try to explore whether we have more in common than divides us. And we do this by presenting conversations with people on the street on different topics each week and in-depth interviews with inspiring guests from all areas of the arts. And if you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all past shows there, some very interesting topics and wonderful guests. You can hear this show again if you so wish afterwards, or let your friends know about it. And you can also connect with me on social media. So again, that's itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing one of America's most celebrated illustrators, Myra Kalman. An illustrator, writer, and product designer, Myra has written and illustrated over 18 children's books, as well as producing award-winning books for adults and designing all kinds of objects, such as fabric, bags, clocks. Born in Tel Aviv, she moved to America at the age of 4 and was raised in the Bronx, and she now lives in Manhattan. Myra is a frequent contributor to the New Yorker magazine and is well known for her collaboration with Rick Meyerowitz on the New Yorker Stan cover in 2001 and the New York City subculinary map. Myra has an amazing body of creative work, which includes projects such as illustrating Strunken White's classic The Elements of Style, a small opera based on text composed by Nico Muley, collaborations with designers like Isaac Mizrahi and Kate Spade, and two hugely popular monthly online columns she created for the New York Times, the first of which, The Principles of Uncertainty, was a narrative journal of her life, and the second, And the Pursuit of Happiness, a year-long exploration of American history and democracy. Both columns are now collected in book form. Myra has had 8 exhibitions at the Julie Saul Gallery since 2003, and in 2010, the Institute of Contemporary Art Philadelphia organized a retrospective of Myra's work entitled Myra Kalman, Various Illuminations of a Crazy World. She has collaborated with Michael Pollan to illustrate his acclaimed Food Rules and published Girls on Lawns with text by Daniel Handler, which is the first of 5 books she will be doing with the photography department of the Museum of Modern Art. Her most recent book, which has just come out, is Beloved Dog, a book of wise words and whimsical pictures, which celebrates the sage lessons animals teach us. Welcome to the show, Myra. You express your life, your thoughts, your feelings and impressions so beautifully in your work. I'm wondering if you can remember the first interaction you had with a book or picture that impressed upon you the emotional power of art, that perhaps made you want to become an artist.
It's funny because I remember very vividly the book that I read that I was sure I was going to be a writer, because that's what I knew I wanted to be, and it was Pippi Longstocking. Mm. It was absolutely this irrepressible girl who was fearless and controlled her own destiny with a great sense of humor, and I thought, when I read that, I was probably around 8 years old or something like that, I thought, okay, that's for me. And I also read The Secret Garden at the same time, which was another extraordinary book, and I thought, well, I really like these British great houses and British gardens. I better go there one day, which is now something that I do.
Oh, so you have been now.
Very many times, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, The Secret Garden is a really sort of mystical book almost, isn't it? The way it draws you into this sort of other world. I think you can read it on lots of different layers.
Yeah, I love it. I think it resonates that way.
Yeah. I was wondering, would you say you grew up in a creative environment when you were growing up?
I think it was incredibly creative because there was no forcing of any kind of knowledge or learning. There was a lot of storytelling. There was a great sense of humor. I was left to daydream. There were piano lessons, of course, and going to museums, but it was all with a very light hand. It was all very much just do what you can and hopefully you'll love it, as opposed to proving yourself with something.
Yeah, you've said that growing up, your encouragement came not from being told to do this or that, but from being loved and told that whatever you did was great. And I was thinking what an amazing and sadly rare gift that was. It must have given you a sense that you could at least attempt anything.
Yes, I mean, you know, coupled with the normal fears of any human being and the doubts and the sorrows, the sense that, and I talk about that, you know, as a sense of unconditional love, that if you feel you've received that when you're young, it really sustains you and comforts you through anything in your life. So I was really fortunate, and it is a big leap for a parent to do that, because you're trembling all the time at what your child might do, which comes to pass. There's a reason to be nervous.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. But I think also there's, you know, so many people haven't worked through their own kind of emotional issues, perhaps from their own childhood, that when it comes to their own children, they're still doing that, which can interfere with that sort of giving it unconditional love, perhaps.
Yeah, well, it's a messy process, the whole thing.
Yeah, that is very true. And you're just so desperately trying to do your best, aren't you, as a parent?
So, I think. That's what I opened to my kids. I did the best I could.
Yeah. So when did you know that you wanted to pursue an artistic career professionally?
I was in college, and I was very unhappy with my writing. I was a creative writing major, and I thought, this is really terrible writing, and I can't handle the pressure of creating the written word. So I thought, wouldn't it be easy and fun to draw and to be a narrative illustrator? So I thought, I'll just do that. And I started to draw and to paint. And my style has clearly evolved over the years, but I threw myself into it with a certainty that I was quite sure that I would be able to do what I wanted to do. I don't know where I got that certainty, because I worry about everything, but that takes up most of my time. But I really just felt that I had found my voice in a way.
Yes, yeah. And once you decided that was what you wanted to do as a career, how did you start out actually trying to do it in the world?
In the world at the time, you could go around with an actual portfolio and knock on the actual doors of actual magazines and leave your portfolio there and hope that somebody said, here's an assignment. And that's what happened little by little. Of course, there were many rejections in the beginning, but I had created a group of drawings that I thought represented my style and my sense of humor. And then it's true, that sense of perseverance, that sense of, it may take me longer than I thought it should. It may be a zigzaggy road, but I know that I'm on the right road.
Yes.
So it took a few years before I started to get work. So I was, you know, happily a waitress, which I adored doing, and things to pay the rent.
What did you like about being a waitress?
I love the spontaneity of the superficial conversations that happen many, many times during the course of the day, because I don't think they're superficial at all. I think those interactions with people, very elemental, about giving people food, getting paid for your service, everybody having an occupation. It's always heartbreaking to watch people eat. I always, you know, I write about that, especially when they eat soup. So there's a tremendous level of humanity in that job. I haven't done it in a while, but I wouldn't mind doing it again.
When you say it's heartbreaking to watch people eat, what do you mean by that?
I always bring the heartbreak into things. That everybody is, you know, that we're all on this earth. We don't know how we got here. Well, we know how we got here, but we don't know why we're here.
Right.
For many of us, we don't know why we're here. And this heroic sense of trying to make sense of the world and trying to find your place and your family and your love and your work, it's very hard to do. So, but we all need to eat something. And then there's this moment where we just are lost in ourselves, where it's sustaining our life. And I find it so moving and so tender that the universality of everybody needing to sit down and eat something to get the energy to go on with whatever it is that they need to do.
Right, yeah. That's something that we all have, no matter what position we're in our life.
Yeah. Of course, there's some common connectors for humanity, and that's certainly one of the strongest.
Yeah. Wow, I never thought about that before. I'll have a different view now when I'm watching people eat.
You'll be standing there weeping, and I'll say, what's wrong with you? Why are you crying? I'll say, well, it's just something.
I'll say, it's Myra Kalman's fault. Or her gift, that now I'm, seeing things in a different way. I think, any means that we can increase our empathy and compassion, I think is worthwhile, because it's very easy, particularly nowadays, and with all the devices we've got and people buried in them, to not really even notice other people.
Yeah, there's a tremendous head buried into a device that's in your hand, and you don't notice other people, and you don't notice the things that are around you. So taking a walk and looking at trees, for instance, which is probably one of the most glorious things that any human being could do, often people are not looking at their trees, they're looking at their device. So,
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you describe yourself as an illustrator rather than an artist, even though you paint. Can you explain why you prefer that moniker?
I'm hiding behind the illustrator description. I think I have a very strong sense of the assignment, a very strong sense of the commercial part of the world. I like getting paid for my work and for my occupation, and I feel like I'm Lois Lane, that I'm sent on assignment in a way that I think of myself as a journalist. So I'm sent on assignment, and I observe the world, and I send you my impressions, but I happen to do it with paintings and with writing. It's not the same as going into a studio and creating a body of work, which is a different kind of expression. Mm. That doesn't hold that much interest to me. I like the interaction with editors. I like the sense that that there's a quick turnaround. And maybe I'm impatient, maybe I get easily bored, but I do like the idea that also that you don't know what the next assignment is going to be. Even when I generate my own work, I want to surprise myself with what is my assignment. So it gives me a grounded feeling, which is elusive to begin with. So, you hold on to as much as you can.
Mm. So somewhat goal-oriented, your process in a way.
Very goal-oriented, and it liberates me. It liberates my mind if I am given the assignment, it's quite liberating and delightful to go off point and digress. And for me, going off point is the point.
Mm.
So I'm able to do that having been given the assignment. Ground.
Yeah.
Now go and take off in the direction that you want to.
Yeah.
And I also want to communicate with people. That's part of my why I do what I do, that I don't want to be inaccessible. I don't want to be esoteric. There may be things that are absurd in my work, but certainly there's enough humor and enough, as you said before, compassion, that you feel connected as opposed to alienated by my depressions and my flight.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I think that you do definitely achieve that. If you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, one of America's most celebrated illustrators, Myra Kalman. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
The music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland. Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Just goes nowhere. It's well, It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore, and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest this week, illustrator, journalist, and product designer, Myra Kalman. And we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz in the break there, and I wanted to let you know that Myra is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on November the 14th at 7 p.m. in conversation with Michael Wirtz, talking about her new book, Beloved Dog. So it's an opportunity there for you to meet her in person. I'm hoping to go, so I hope to see you there. So again, that's November 14th, 7 p.m., Bookshop Santa Cruz, and you can find out information at their website, bookshopsantacruz.com. So I wanted to ask you, Myra, the interaction of image and text is at the core of your work in your books and illustrations. So where did the impetus come from to combine word and image? Where did that begin?
Very influenced by a lot of the Dadaists and Surrealists who use text and type in their work, combining art. You know, so this is certainly not something new. And then later on, of course, the work of Saul Steinberg, who was greatly influential, and Charlotte Solomon, who was a painter in the 30s, who was killed in the Holocaust, but had done a beautiful series of gouaches with text on them called Life or Opera, a kind of memoir, an illustrated memoir. So there are many places where you can look and see text and art combined. And certainly in children's books, that's one of the great places where you combine text and art.
Mm.
So a lot of precedents for it, and a lot of, and everywhere we look around us, we see a lot of text, and we see a lot of art and photography.
Mm. Yeah.
It's always mixing everything you see, movie posters and advertisements for shampoo. So it's really part of our life.
Yeah, absolutely. You use handwritten text in most of your projects. What's the significance of that for you?
It was probably easy and cheap. Two really important things to do. Easy, fast, and cheap. I always loved my penmanship. That's really one of the things I was very proud of when I was a child, and something that's also perhaps not that prevalent anymore. And I think that, of course, typography is a very beautiful subject. I'm crazy about typefaces. My daughter's middle name is Bodoni, which is a beautiful 18th century typeface created by a man named Bodoni from Parma, Italy. And so when my husband and I started a design firm that went parallel with my book career, my writing career, we were very aware of the beauty of text. We adore books, the paper, the typeface, it's all quite extraordinary. For me, these are precious, holy objects, and so all of it is interesting.
Yeah, that, of course, because if you go back in time when, a very tiny percentage of people actually were able to write, I mean, the actual craftsmanship of writing was part of the act. I mean, if you think of all the monks,
yes,
in medieval times creating all these beautiful texts.
The scribes.
Yeah, it really was a work of art as well as conveying information. But
also something else that happens when you're using a pen or a pencil on paper, The brain is creating a lot of connections that it doesn't do in other ways. And also, I'm really a great believer in mistakes, that, you know, doodling or that kind of freedom. Something is released in your brain when your hand is using a pencil, and you have this great joy in what you create, whether you expect it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's really interesting that there's been quite a bit of research recently about what it means to put pen or pencil to paper. And they've found, for instance, that students who take notes by hand remember the content of a lecture much better than if they are typing on a laptop.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there's definitely something more organic or more, I don't know, magical even when you actually are writing,
yeah.
Isn't there?
Yeah, I think so.
You have a new book out. Now, I would call it Beloved Dog, coming from Britain, but would it be Beloved Dog in America?
No, I say the way you say it, Beloved.
Beloved Dog.
Beloved Dog. I must be British somewhere inside of me. Yes, Beloved Dog, absolutely.
Yeah, and you say that it explores the dearest, funniest, lovingest, loyalest of friends, a canine companion. It's a large hardback book filled with full-color illustrations and your philosophical musings. Now, I understand that you used to be really scared of dogs, so can you tell us a bit about what inspired you to create this work?
Well, my family came from the scared of all animals, why would we ever bring one into our home kind of philosophy. And clearly, when you turn your back on one, there's an attack that will come because they're an animal. And so there was some kind of comfort in not having any interactions with any animals at all. So when the reason that we got a dog was a very sad one. My husband was quite ill, and the idea of a dog helping all of us deal with the sorrow of his illness was something that I thought, well, that I don't want to do that, but then I decided to. So that's why we got our dog.
Yeah, and that's Pete, and part of the book is about Pete, who sort of helped you somewhat through this tragedy of your husband's death. And I was thinking, I almost think dogs are like angels sometimes, in that they perfectly embody this sort of selfless love. And I think that's part of what you're celebrating in this book, the unconditional love of dogs.
Yes, it's true. They really are like angels. They don't talk. They absorb all grief. They never judge. You know, all the things that you need the most when you're going through really wretched and difficult times is just somebody being constant and giving you that completely unjudgmental, unconditional love. And for some reason, dogs are on this earth, and they fulfill that role, which is extraordinary, and then bring out a tremendous amount of love that comes from you back to them. They just absorb so much that they are angels.
Yeah, I think that's true what you say. It's kind of, they bring out the better part of us as well, don't they? I mean, just receiving that kind of devotion and love.
Yes, it's true. And so hopefully we return it.
Yes. Yeah. When I was driving to the station today, I saw a homeless man with his little dog walking along, and I was just feeling, I don't know, I went into a little digression, as you would say, of thinking like, oh my goodness, supposing he couldn't feed his dog and had to give him up, and oh, how tragic that would be. And, you know, hopefully someone would step in and enable him to just be able to provide the dog with food so that, you know, he could keep his companion. Because, I mean, it can change your whole life, can't it, to have...
Absolutely. No, it completely changes your life, and it becomes epic in that way as you look at this. You know, this man and his dog, and you just think of the epic moments in your life and what is important and how you go about it. So these stories are really they're monumental.
Yes, yeah. And I was reading, you know, sort of various comments on this book that you've written, and you sort of expressed, not surprise exactly, but you realized that you had included dogs in a lot of your work in the past.
I know, I said, my God, I must be completely obsessed with dogs, because I put them into every painting, whether I needed to or not, way before I got a dog. So clearly they represented something to me that was charming and funny, and even though I kept my distance, I understood that there was something important going on here. I couldn't get near it until later on.
Yeah, and what's it like having a dog in a big city like New York?
Well, everything is great in New York. You know, we just having so much fun here. I really do adore, I mean, and I mean that, I really do adore New York, and it's such an interesting and wonderful place. And when you go for a walk, and if you think of the city being cold and impersonal, just take a dog for a walk around the block. You'll meet 50 people, and everybody will be talking with everybody, and it'll seem like the most charming, friendly village that you've ever been in, because there is that sense that when you're, you know, I always used to add another half an hour to anywhere that I was going, because we'd stop so many times with Pete and talk to people and casually, you know, the chit-chat of the day. And those moments are glorious. I think those are the best moments of life, those unplanned little moments. I mean, similar to the waitress having an exchange with a patron. It's just those moments burst out of you in the sweetest way. And then you go about your business. So it's incredible to have a dog in New York.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you just have a dog, someone else with a dog. Instantly, they just have this unconscious sense of connection that means they just reach out to you perfectly, artlessly, really, whereas two people just walking along would never do that.
No, that would be too much of an effort. But here, and of course, we're talking about each other's dogs. We're not really interested in each other. But that's okay, too. Everybody's having a nice time.
Yes, that's true. You've produced many works for children and adults. I was wondering, would you say that Beloved Dog is for all ages?
You know, it's funny because I was thinking, I thought it was an adult book. I didn't even think of kids. But a friend of mine read it to his six-year-old son and said, of course it's for kids. I mean, there are sad parts, too, but children are allowed to know about sad things and the sense of something sad can happen, but something glorious and can resurrect you and comfort you. So I guess it's for everybody. I hope so.
Yeah.
Or maybe, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. It's certainly a beautifully presented book. It's lovely.
I managed to put Winston Churchill in there. Do you notice him on the end paper? Winston Churchill walking his dog. And Queen Victoria. Queen Victoria is on one end paper looking miserable, but I like her very much. And Winston Churchill.
They're great.
Yeah.
And
Vita Sackville West is also in there. So they're clearly the British great house and is important to me.
Well, I think, you know, the whole Englishman and his dog, or English person, we would say now, and his dog. I mean, dogs are incredibly important to British people. That's cool.
I mean, that's what I was always sensed that, you know, that if you're a Jew from the Bronx, it couldn't be further from, like, Vita Sackville West in her great house in Sissinghurst. And yet, somehow, we're connected. That's a nice thing.
That's true. I was looking at all the wonderful visual word pieces you've created for magazines such as Departures and Mindful, and it made me curious how you begin a work when you're not specifically illustrating something. You know, is it a thought, a feeling? Do the words come first or the images, or is it a mix of everything?
It's a big confused mess for a while. I really do wander around and try to walk, as I say, with an empty brain and allow things to percolate and to reveal themselves. But I'm looking at a lot of things. I'm falling in love with a lot of things. I'm listening to music and reading, looking at books. And, you know, when I get an assignment and do research, travel to the places where I'm supposed to go. When I did the pieces for Mindful, I went on a silent retreat and, the things that are related to it that I'm curious about. I mean, that's what you need most is the sense of curiosity, which I have a good amount of. Mm. So, and then if I'm researching Lincoln, then I go to Springfield and stay at the bed and breakfast at Mary Todd Lincoln Room, you know, those kinds of things. I enjoy that so much because it's the serendipity of what happens to you along the way that you're doing the research. Again, it's going off point, but having a reason to do it. So there's just a whole big mix of things. And then I write a lot, and then I edit it down, and I always sketch in my sketchbook and have a camera. So it's a living process for me. Mm. A lot of fun.
Now, you're obviously passionate about many, many things in life. So how do you decide which passions to make into art?
Well, you can only do what you can do. So I guess that's the sense of how you edit your life. You know, that the things that keep coming up and up again and resonating. And when I was doing the piece for the New York Times, The Principles of Uncertainty. It was really about, well, what's on my mind this month?
Mm.
And how do you incorporate all the wonderful things that are going on and this and the tragic things that are going on, and how do you express those? So it just keeps swirling about. I got, feverish brain. I go to bed early. I'm so tired by the end of the day.
Yes, I can imagine. You share your intimate thoughts and feelings through your art, your impressions, observations, deductions. I'm wondering how much self-consciousness there is in that as you produce your work, whether you consider how what you are producing will be received or whether you're just kind of flowing with the inspiration.
Well, I'm aware that I'm writing for people in the audience of adults and or children, and I'm aware that I want to communicate. But I also, at that, then you leave off the audience, and, you know, as many writers say, you're really telling a story that you need to tell, and that you just do it the best you can. Sometimes, you know, and it's a mix. Sometimes I'm very self-conscious. Sometimes I forget about everything and go in this wonderful reverie. And then other times it isn't working well, and you have to try a different approach. So, the thing that I've, the most constant, of course, is being inconsistent. And that is okay. You can find out that you're allowed to be inconsistent in this world and sometimes be something and then sometimes be something else.
Yes.
So it's just about about continuing to work.
Right, yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, illustrator, journalist, and product designer, Myra Kalman. We're going to go to some messages now, but we'll be back very soon.
Imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest, illustrator, journalist, and product designer, Myra Kelman, and I wanted to let you know, if you wanted more information about Myra and her work, you can go to her website, myrakalman.com, and that's myrakalman.com. And in this area, you have the opportunity to see Myra in person November 14th, 7 p.m. at Bookshop Santa Cruz. She's going to be in conversation with Michael Wirtz, talking about her new book, Beloved Dog, which is a beautiful full-color book that's just coming out. And also, she's going to be in San Francisco on November the 13th at a great good place for books. So two opportunities for you to see Myra in person there. I wanted to ask you, Myra, your paintings are colourful, exuberant, naive, whimsical. I'm always curious how painters find their particular style, you know, why this way and not another. Is that something you can put into words, why you depict things in the style you do, or is it more of an unconscious evolution of artistic energy?
I think every artist is influenced by other artists. Mm. And that you find when you're developing and when you're looking at all the different styles of art that are around you, some things just, you know, ping inside of you and you go, that's the world I want to be in. I think that, you know, of course you can try different worlds and not be sure, but I think for the most part, you know, after some amount of time, you say, oh, this speaks to me, this kind of material, this color palette, this sensibility, and you just know when you feel this connection, you just have like this electrical kind of reaction to things, and it's philosophical, the subject matter, the approach. So you just, if you're not feeling it, then something is wrong. You must be feeling it with some number of artists that you're looking at over the years, and you can add people on and decide you don't like some people later on, but basically, I think that's the biggest response. You're responding to the kind of art that you see around you and say, okay, who am I in this?
Yeah, yeah, interesting.
But it's instinct. It's very visceral.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, well, interesting. In your piece on beauty, broken and unbroken, in Shiseido Hanatsubaki magazine, one picture includes the words, "Sometimes it is important to lie down under a tree and feel nature. The tree is full of leaves, the birds sing, the breeze is gentle. Your eyes close slowly and you sleep a little. What could you dream about? What heartbreak could you forget for a little while?" I'm wondering what you think of the place of art as a means to connect us to the natural world and perhaps prompt us to make connections within ourselves.
I think that the art that I love and that I look to makes me feel most connected to the world, makes me feel that there's a purpose, that there's a reason that I'm here, however elusive that is, that or intangible, that there is a sense of beauty and order and meaning. And it's very akin to nature, because when you take a walk and you're looking at trees, of course the sense of well-being that you have is really heightened. I mean, you know, obviously there are exceptions, but for the most part, taking a walk and looking at trees and sitting under a tree and looking at the leaves and listening to the birds gives you a great sense of well-being and contentment. And I think that in the ideal world, you'd be getting those things from the works of art that you love and from the nature that's around you.
Mm. It does seem that we are becoming, certainly in the West, more disconnected from that kind of natural part of the outer world and in our inner world. Is that something you feel you want to address at all in your work?
You know, it's hard to know what's actually going on in the world. I don't know whether that's a pretty broad statement, right? I don't know what's going on in the world, but the sense of you know, we're things are always changing and the world is evolving. So I don't even know what to make of all of the different aspects of what we have to deal with. Though it seems that things are more complex now, but maybe they're not. Maybe it was always just a different kind of complicated.
Yeah.
Maybe more information. I keep saying that there are too many things. That's what I usually go to say, saying that there are too many things and I really want to simplify, which is a nice thing to think about.
Yes, yeah. I think that there's definitely that impetus for those of us who are fortunate enough to be at a level to have things. It does seem like we do have a lot of things compared with people in the past. Definitely.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And you have created quite a few things, objects. Yeah. What interests you in producing things?
It's funny because like one has to apologize. I'm sorry, but I've created some things that are in this world. So forgive me. But of course, besides creating books and having them as things to take up room in a library, I have a really vast library, and I look at it and I go, what am I going to do with all of these books? But I couldn't imagine not having them.
Mm.
So in our design studio at Emin Company, we were always interested in the quirkiness of projects and products, and decided that it would be fun to do things as our own clients. So Tibor, my husband, loved to design anything that was, it was just a question of solving a problem and using your imagination. So you could design a watch or an umbrella. So as we did, watches and then umbrellas and various accessories. He used to call them design pornography, but it was paperweights and just things that are not critical to life, but add a certain kind of whimsy. And people do like to have things around them, so it keeps changing. But
I think
we used to say in my family, even Gandhi had a spoon. I think that's all he had.
I think there's something really fun as well, or even. Perhaps meaningful about combining beauty and function. You know, when you have something that actually has a purpose, but it's also beautiful. I think there's something very satisfying about that.
There is. I mean, we really, you know, not everybody does, but I really love to look around the landscape of my room and really love the things that I have. So I'm crazy about chairs. So I have what I think are beautiful chairs, and I like ladders, so I have ladders sprinkled around the apartment that I think are beautifully designed.
Oh,
and
great.
It keeps changing. You know, I keep moving things around, but it's a kind of a delight. You're curating your own life museum, whatever it is, and I find great satisfaction in that.
Yeah. What do you like about ladders?
That's a good question. I love the fact that they are ladder-like,
mm-hmm.
that they have ladderosity. I think that they are exactly what you said. They're both utilitarian. You know, you need to climb up to reach something. What is that something? It might be a bowl or it might be a book, and then you climb down. And I also think the structures are really beautiful, the industrial structure of a ladder from a handmade one to a very serious one from a hardware store. So
yeah.
I don't know why I fell in love with them, but I did.
Well, there's also that aspect of you, if you think of sort of snakes and ladders, of connection that it enables you to get from one place to another that you wouldn't have been able to without that ladder.
Yeah, it lets you climb.
Yeah. Your husband, Tibor Kalman, was your companion for 32 years and was a phenomenally talented, creative person also. So few people these days manage to maintain relationships for that length of time, and perhaps even fewer do that with someone who shares a deep understanding of their own passions. So I was wondering if you don't mind me asking how your relationship with Tibor informed your artistic work.
He affected me and influenced me in the most profound way that I could possibly imagine. And it's interesting, we met due to the fact that we were both flunking out of our courses at NYU and had to go to summer school to make up a summer economics class. So I think that luck has something to play with it, something to say about it, because there we were in this summer economics class.
Mm.
I don't think either of us could care less, but but there we are, and then we met each other when we were just turning 19.
Mm.
So I met somebody who immediately was my best friend, immediately understood, had a great sense of humor, and who was also curious and passionate about many, many things. He wanted to blow up the university. It was the late 60s, and you know, as I say in my book, and I wanted to knit him a sweater, so he didn't blow up the university, and I did knit him a sweater. But we found kindred spirits in each other, and that's the luck of the draw, and we're able to change together and work together, have children together, and constantly be a source of inspiration for each other, which I'm perpetually amazed at. I there's no way to explain that.
I think one of the keys is what you said about you were able to change and grow together. I think that's one of the key things to staying with someone, and that also being a fulfilling experience. You know, sometimes that just isn't possible for people to change or to grow together.
Yeah. I mean, you change and then you grow apart, or many, you know, so many things happen and so many things inform what happens. But we were lucky.
Yes. Yeah. You've produced such an amazing body of work. Do you still try to challenge yourself as an artist creatively?
It's interesting. It also goes back to Tibor a little bit because of his fearlessness and his sense of drive, that what you do is you just keep on going and you keep working and you keep adding on to your interests and to your pursuits. So I hope to challenge my... Yeah, I'm working on a bunch of new projects now, which certainly will challenge me. One is co-creating a ballet with this wonderful choreographer, John Higginbotham. And I don't quite know what it is that we're going to be doing, but we're going to be doing something in a few years that will premiere at Jacob's Pillow. And I just did a piece, another dance piece, with Monica Bill Barnes, who's another wonderful choreographer. So, and I co-curated this museum installation that my son and I did of my mother's underwear closet in an alley in Cortland Alley. And, you know, so for those of you who are coming to New York, on Cortland Alley, Sarah Berman's closet is what we curated. So I always want to find something that feels natural and organic and delightful and interesting to continue to pursue, including books and painting and writing and traveling and taking piano lessons and all kinds of things.
Right. What are the criteria you want to meet when producing your work in order to feel creatively satisfied with it?
The minute I like something, like, you know, half an hour later, I could say, oh my God, it's terrible, and I can't imagine why I liked it before. It's such a changing, fluid thing. I think that the criteria would be that I felt it did as close as possible to what I was hoping to achieve in my mind's eye, as they say. So it would incorporate some kind of mystery and some kind of humor and some kind of tenderness, acknowledgement of sadness, acknowledgement of joy, a lot of things going on at once, actually, is what I would, you know, would ask for, which is confusing. So it's a little bit confusing.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Art is, of course, about communication. And so I'm wondering, is there anything you're trying to consciously convey? Do you see themes running through your work?
I think that I'm probably most interested in conveying the vulnerability of people, the fragility of life, and at the exact same time, the beauty and the terrific grandness of it all, and how we can live with those two emotions, those two extreme emotions at the same time, that you can be in complete despair and also be tremendously happy at the same time.
Yeah, I was reading in On Beauty, Broken and Unbroken, you write, dread and delight at the same time. That is the joy of being alive. I thought that was a great quote, you know, just it's so true. And but to find joy in that sort of counterpoint of dread and delight, I think shows your kind of optimistic or hopeful view of life.
I do, when it's not 3 in the morning, when everything looks bleak, I do have a sense of optimism, but it's very small optimism. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means, but I think it's small. It's personal, limited optimism, which maybe is fine.
Right, yeah. Well, maybe in a way that's the best kind, because it's not sort of grandiose. It's not out of reach. It's sort of within your own world.
Yeah. I'm optimistic that I will have a nice cup of coffee later on today, and I will look at the leaves shimmering on the tree. I'm optimistic about that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think your optimism is probably going to be fulfilled.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming towards the end of the show now. I did just briefly want to mention that there's going to be an exhibition of the paintings from Beloved Dog in New York. Is that right?
Yes, at the Julie Saul Gallery, S-A-U-L Gallery. Wonderful gallery in New York City.
And is it going to be all of them? Because there's a lot.
Not all of them.
No.
A selection.
Yeah. It's a really stunningly attractive book. You know, it's so full of life and vibrancy. What do you hope people take away from Beloved Dog?
Oh, my God. I hope they take away a sense of sweet humor and kind love or something like that.
And get a dog if they don't have one.
And get a dog. If they want one.
Yes. I think anyone would want a dog after reading this book.
Yeah.
It's a really beautiful book. Well, thank you so much for your time, Maya, and coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And wish you all the best with your book tour for Beloved Dog.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. So just to remind listeners again, if you want more information on Maira, you can go to her website. And again, that's MairaKalman.com. It's a fabulous website. She has whole pages of all the wonderful pieces that she's done in different magazines. So you can really get a sense of her work and art and her wonderful, whimsical philosophizing. It's really worth a visit. And if you enjoy this interview, remember, if you're in this area, you will be able to see Maira at Bookshop Santa Cruz on November 14th, 7 p.m. in conversation with Michael Wirt. So again, November 14th, 7 p.m. Hopefully you can make it along to that. You'll be able to get some inside info from her on Beloved Dog, meet her in person, and perhaps get your book signed as well. Just also to remind you about our website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. Podcasts of all previous shows there. We've had some really stimulating topic discussions and also some wonderful arts guests. So you can listen to the podcast there. You can also connect with me on social media, should you wish, and email me if you have comments, ruth@itsaquestionofbalance.com. So I hope you might visit the website. That's us for this week. Look forward to seeing you next week with more wonderful arts guests and more topics. So as I said, if you have any ideas of who you'd like me to interview or who you would or topics that you would like me to discuss, do let me know. Again, that's ruth@itsaquestionofbalance.com. I'll see you next week.